Blog Talk Radio.
I just finished chugging coffee 3 seconds before I came on air here. I usually have all morning to do preparing for the show, but I had to get fitted for a wedding I'm going to, so I had to go to a place where they put the tux on and everything. I went to this place recently. I lost a decent amount of weight since the last time I was there, and I told them, I'm like, yeah, I lost probably about 15 pounds or so from the last time I came here, and they started measuring me. They're like, yeah. You're exactly the same. I was like, what? I lost weight. I promise I lost weight. You know when somebody, says something so definitively that they almost make you think you lied? Even though I know I didn't lie, but they made me think, did I not lose weight? What's happening here? And then when I had to put the jacket on and button it, they were like, yeah, that's where you lost weight. I lost it from my belly. I didn't lose it from my waist, so, the measuring around the waist was exactly the same as last time. But anyway, that's a very long way of me trying to tell you that I jammed in all my preparation into 70% of the time I would normally do it. I would tell you that the show's going to suck, but I actually don't think it is. I would be honest about that. If I honestly thought that the show was going to be shitty, I would say that up front. I'd say today is going to be a shitty show, just a heads up. But it's not. I actually managed to squeeze in a good amount of preparation. So, forgive me, I'm still drinking as I come on here. Here's what you guys have to look forward to. There's been some anger on the right about the response to the recent Amtrak crash. We're going to go ahead and destroy all the people who were attacking liberals on that because they're dead wrong. They got mad that we dare to bring up infrastructure when there's a crash that happens involving our infrastructure. Oh, how irrational of us to bring up problems with infrastructure after a fucking crash that involved our infrastructure. I know. So we'll talk about that. Then also, we have some amazing hypocrisy on the issue of abortion that we'll talk about. We have the Republicans giving more power to President Obama, even though they say that they're against him and they're fighting him. It depends on the issue. All the issues where they should fight him, they're not. They're rolling over. Eric Bolling contradicts himself on free speech. Bill O'Reilly makes an ass out of himself again involving poverty. We have a super sexist rant from a Fox News host. We have Sam Harris and Noam Chomsky go at it. I wasn't going to cover that originally, but now Sam did some follow-ups to it. Now I want to respond to it, so a lot of stuff to talk about. So let's go ahead and kick it off here, and we'll do that with the Amtrak crash. Might as well. So there's been some anger on the right about the response to the recent Amtrak crash. People like Megyn Kelly have said, how dare liberals politicize this issue? She was scathing in her response, and she basically said, well, go ahead and tell me how infrastructure spending would have prevented this crash. And the implication was, of course it wouldn't. Shut up, you liberals trying to take advantage of a tragedy. That's the idea that she was getting at. But today, allow me to say this. Megyn Kelly, challenge accepted. You asked us to explain to you how infrastructure spending could have prevented this crash. Well, here we go. Think Progress reports, quote, the train involved in the deadly crash in Pennsylvania on Tuesday was reportedly going more than 100 miles per hour in a 50-mile-per-hour zone. So let's pause there. This is where the conservatives go, ah, you see, you stupid fucking liberals always wanting to, you know, fix infrastructure in America, you bring up that talking point too soon. This crash had nothing to do with that because the guy was speeding the train. That's the problem. Blame the individual. This is about personal responsibility. This is not about our infrastructure in any way, shape, or form. Hold on to that thought. They say, quote, according to federal officials, technology that could have remotely slowed the train, which the president of Amtrak has called the most important rail safety advancement of our time, has been installed on much of the Northeast Corridor, but was not operational in the section where the train derailed. And if some in the Senate have their way, Republicans, it may not be in place for another 5 years. Whoa. For decades, the National Transportation Safety Board has urged the nation's railroads to implement a technology called Positive Train Control Systems, or PTC. This technology would allow railroads to use GPS to stop or slow trains in cases of driver emergencies, switches left in the wrong position, hijacking, natural disasters, or other human error. So, in other words, we already had the technology to basically put a governor on the speed of the trains and to slow it down regardless of what, you know, the person actually driving the train is doing. That technology exists. It's just a matter of fully funding it and implementing it and making it operational, which takes time and effort and money. The technology exists, but it wasn't working on this train. Why wasn't it working? Goes right back to the original point that I made at the time and other progressives made at the time. Because we don't give a flying fuck about our infrastructure in any serious way. Now, to be clear, they did actually, there were Democrats who successfully got a bill through that started us going down this path of implementing it, which is why in many areas in the Northeast we actually have it functioning. But they haven't made it fully operational yet. So it would require more funding and more attention and fixing a problem, namely making it operational on the specific train, where this happened. So the idea that, you know, oh, there's nothing that could have been done to prevent this, that's crazy to say that. That's demonstrably untrue. We could have fully funded this technology on all trains. We could have it operational on all trains if we just gave a shit to do it. Or, as I said originally, we're having this conversation about, like, whether we should slightly upgrade our pathetically shitty infrastructure or do nothing at all, when the real debate we should be having is, should we update our infrastructure or should we try to get the number one infrastructure in the world and get, you know, like those bullet trains, for example, get newer trains that are up to date that are essentially crash-proof in many respects? Why would we not have that conversation? So even if this wasn't the case, this is the point, man, even if this wasn't the case and we didn't have this funding issue with the thing that could check the speed from externally, it would still be the case that the problem is our shitty infrastructure. Megyn Kelly might want to deny that. Another conservative might want to deny that and say, oh, don't blame that because then we actually have to address the problem. But it is something we should care about. It is something we should address. Because if it's preventable in any way, shape, or form, why would we not say that that's the solution? Of course it's the solution. Whether you upgrade the systems that are in place and make them operational and spread out these current systems that are already available, or whether you totally update to bullet trains, there is an answer. And the answer is not blaming liberals when they bring up the proper solutions after a crisis. That should be obvious, but that's not the case to the Republicans. Okay. All right, now we're going to go to abortion. Sorry, I keep chugging my drink because, like I said, I just ate. Now, oftentimes on the show, we discuss the issue of abortion, and at this point, many of my listeners are aware that I describe myself as a moderate on that issue. I think it's basically 100% the woman's choice until viability, which is about 23 weeks, and then I would only allow after that abortions in the case of rape or incest or if the life of the mother is in danger or if there's a defect in the fetus and the fetus isn't going to survive anyway. So again, I think that's a fairly moderate position. And by the way, polling data on this shows that most Americans actually agree with me. So they're not really on the far right where they're like ban them all, and they're not even on the far left where they say allow abortions until, you know, right before birth, like late term abortions are cool in all circumstances. Now, the American people are fairly moderate, again, where I think I fall in this debate. So the Republicans have presented a bill that on its face appears to be fairly reasonable on the issue of abortion. But of course it's really not. So hold tight here and I'll explain why. It's a 20-week abortion ban. And again, at face value, you might say, well, that's about the line where you said you would cut off, Kyle. And I mean, I guess that's in the realm of discussion here. But the gigantic problem with the legislation is that it doesn't allow for important exceptions, the ones that I just laid out for you about, you know, rape and incest and things like that. And by the way, it's unconstitutional. That's another thing. And the conservatives are kind of hypocritical for bringing it up because they always talk about states' rights, and they're trying to take away states' rights by doing a one-size-fits-all abortion policy for every state, whether it's conservative or liberal. So they also have some hypocrisy issues there. And remember, it is unconstitutional because according to Roe versus Wade and the subsequent abortion cases, you cannot in America limit abortion prior to 23 weeks. So for them to propose a bill that says we're going to ban it after 20 weeks, no exceptions, well, you just brazenly spit in the face of the Supreme Court and the Constitution and said, we don't care about what you said. We're going to try to override it with federal law, even though you can't override something, you know, with federal law when it's a constitutional issue and the Supreme Court has already ruled on it. So they really don't know what the fuck they're doing, and they're kind of making asses of themselves, as they always do on many issues. But get this, 242 members of the House voted in favor of the ban, including a guy named Representative Scott Desjarlais. He's a Republican of Tennessee. That name may sound familiar to you because we've spoken about him in the past. Now, this guy prides himself on his pro-life, pro-family voting record, and he has a 100% score from the National Right to Life Committee. So, with a guy like Scott Desjarlais, what you don't have to worry about is principle, because he's got that 100% score, he's clear about where he stands on this stuff. So there wouldn't happen to be any hypocrisy in his personal life on this issue, would there? You may already know where this story is going. Raw Story reports, quote, "Members of the Tennessee and National Press have combed through the 675-page court transcript from Desjarlais' 2001 divorce." By the way, already, family values much? I thought you guys were against divorce. But I continue. "And found that he had sexual relationships with at least two patients, three co-workers, and a drug representative while he was chief of staff at Grand View Medical Center in Jasper, Tennessee." So not only are you a hypocrite talking about family values and getting a divorce when you say you don't believe in divorce, you're also basically boning everybody in sight. Seriously? Sexual relationships with two patients, three co-workers, and a drug representative. Goodness gracious. So during one affair with a female patient, Desjarlais prescribed her drugs for recreational purposes. Again, family values much? Prescribing her drugs to get high, I thought that you're in favor, Mr. I'm in favor of the drug war. Let's lock up people who do recreational drugs. You're prescribing drugs to your mistress so she can get high. He also gave her an $875 watch. I bet his wife really liked that. And bought her a plane ticket to Las Vegas. Again, his wife must love this stuff. One of Desjarlais' mistresses admitted to the press that she had smoked pot with him. We just got violations of your idea of family values all over the place here, buddy. What happened to your morality? What happened to your belief in your religion and that you're supposed to be a stand-up citizen? We're still not at the end here yet. Political reports that Desjarlais' ex-wife accused him of pulling out a gun during an argument. I believe before he did that, he actually asked himself, what would Jesus do? I know, he would pull out a gun and threaten his wife with it. For sure. The hypocrisy is never ending. I still haven't even gotten to the biggest part of the story. You're probably like, what? Come on, Kyle. Seriously, you haven't gotten there? I haven't gotten there yet. I haven't gotten there yet. Remember what this story started with, right? The issue of abortion. Desjarlais defended his ex-wife having two abortions, pressured one of his mistresses to have an abortion after she told him she was pregnant. Oh, these guys are so stupid, man! They're so ridiculous. I think I'm living in a simulation when I read stories like this. Because look at this guy. He's a joke. He's a child. He's a toddler pretending to be a congressman. These guys don't believe anything that they say. All this bullshit about, I believe in Jesus, I'm a Christian, I want to stand up for morals and values, and I'm a good conservative Republican. This is what I believe in. You don't believe in any of that garbage, man. You're just a selfish, narcissistic little prick looking to drop your load off all over the place, and you're contradicting everything you say you believe deeply, every value, every principle that you claim to believe. When it's convenient for you, you're like, I don't want to fuck it. I don't care about that shit. Are you kidding me? Go have an abortion. Hey, let's smoke some weed. What are we doing here? God damn, son. God damn. And the worst part of it all is, so before he was caught, he had that 100 pro-life voting record and voted for the drug war or continuing to crack down in that area. So he voted like that before the scandal broke. Since the scandals have broken, he's still voting that way. It's not like he said, whoops, you got me. I guess clearly I believe in abortion because I've been involved with fucking three of them. No, he's like, I'm against abortions for you. I'm against abortions for liberals and black people and poor people and everybody else. I'm going to morally judge you if you do it. But if I do it, well, you know, shit happens in life. And so I deserve a mulligan every once in a while. Well, you fucking dickhead. Don't you think that's exactly the kind of logic you should apply to others? If you deserve a mulligan, we weren't expecting the kid and we don't want a kid. So what are we going to do? Isn't that exactly what you should say when other people want an abortion? Do as I say, not as I do. That's the Republican approach to life. You know, it reminds me of how we always scream to everybody else, every other country, I should say, about liberty and freedom and democracy and standing up for the right values. But then look at the regimes we support. We just gave a green light to Malaysia to join the TPP when they tolerate slave labor. We're doing a trade deal with the country that does slave labor, and we know about it. And the Obama administration came out this week and said, we got to find a way to make all the Democrats get on board with this whole pro-slavery thing, because we don't want to kick them out of the deal just because they do slavery. Okay, that's fucking insanity. We're buddies with Brunei, who has officially just implemented Sharia law. We scream about democracy and freedom, but look at our track record of who we support overseas. Fascist dictators. And we did that during the Cold War, but even till this day, we support a lot of authoritarian leaders. So when we preach about, oh, democracy and freedom, and we got to have those kinds of systems set up everywhere, that's what we stand for. No, that's not what we stand for. It's not at all what we stand for. We don't give a shit about those things. We care about power and control and natural resources. We're just as selfish as any other empire that's ever been in the same position throughout history. Same with Scott Desjarlais with his personal fucking business. My morality says you can't get an abortion, you can't do drugs, you can't do this, you can't do that. You definitely can't get gay married because sanctity of marriage, everybody, that's what we need to care about. Meanwhile, he's having his mistresses get abortions, he's smoking weed, he's giving out prescription drugs, which, by the way, makes him a fucking drug dealer. He's cheating on his wife left and right. Scott, you ready for this, buddy? This is the harsh truth. You are the problem in America. You are the problem. For you to try to weigh in on moral decisions of other people? Motherfucker, you need to go sit in front of a shrink or a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a therapist or whatever the fuck you want to call it. And you need to get your own shit in order. Don't come fucking talk to us until you take care of your own goddamn business. You got no right to tell anybody else how they can or cannot live because you don't even have your own core value system set up right. You're a giant fucking hypocrite. You stand for nothing except yourself as you judge other people. I'll repeat myself. The problem here in this country is you and people like you. All right. Woo! All right, now we're gonna go to Congress and how they're being ridiculous yet again. Can't wait for that one to get on YouTube. So Congress yet again is struggling with the issue of consistency, and they're struggling with making sense, as I like to call it. So on the issue of Iran, their really hard line in this idea that they need to be able to weigh in. It's not up to President Obama to negotiate any treaties, even though that's exactly what it's up to him to do. We need to have our paw print on the situation, and you need our stamp of approval, and everything needs to come through us. So let's be clear about that. Congress is where you have to come for everything. That's what they say about Iran. On the issue of Obamacare, same thing. Even though it's been approved, even though it's been in place for a long time now, we're going to have 312 different attempts to try to repeal it. And then if it's not repealed, we're still going to say, yeah, it's got to come back to Congress. Everything's got to go through us 8 trillion times. So there, they say essentially the same thing. But then when you get to the issue of the TPP, a funny thing happens. All of a sudden, Congress is arguing we don't even need to see any of the specific provisions in the TPP. We're going to go ahead and give Obama blanket authority to approve whatever the fuck he wants to approve, and we don't even need to see it. We're going to sign over all of our authority. Congress is irrelevant. Do whatever you want, Obama. So there's your issue with consistency and hypocrisy, right? You see how there's a problem with that there? And today we have another issue where they let Obama do whatever he wants, even though they shouldn't let him do whatever he wants. Quote, "The House passed legislation Friday that clears the path for spending tens of billions of dollars on overseas wars, including the one against the Islamic State militants that Congress still hasn't authorized. Lawmakers voted 269 to 151 to pass the Fiscal 2016 National Defense Authorization Act, which would, among other things, permit Congress to spend $89.2 billion on war funding. Republicans allowed 135 amendments to the bill, but they shut out any debate on the need for an authorization for use of military force to put limits on the months-long war against the Islamic State." So let me explain exactly what that means. What that means is they're saying, okay, here's some funding for that. But then when some lawmaker said, funding for what specifically? Put it in writing. What are you exactly funding here? They say, we don't want to weigh in on that. Oh, really? Well, let's have a vote as to whether or not we're officially approving a war against ISIS in Syria. We're going to pass on that and not really declare anything on that. So you see what they're doing? They're doing the opposite of what they were doing with Iran. Iran, they're like, everything comes through us. We need to approve it. With a war, an actual war against ISIS in Syria, a sovereign country, they're like, yeah, Obama, do the war and stuff, like keep killing people, but we don't want to approve it or sign off on it or anything, but hey, here's some fucking money. Keep doing it, keep doing it, keep doing it. Now, why are they doing this? Why are they doing this? Stop and think about it here, because I think everybody out there already kind of knows. Because when it inevitably goes wrong, they want to be able to blame the Democrats and Obama. It's actually politically brilliant. It is. But the problem with it is it's beyond fucking unconstitutional. I mean, the whole idea of the Constitution under the Enumerated Powers Clause, Article 1, Section 8, they say Congress declares war. The president is not allowed to just say, we are going to fight a war tomorrow against Gambia. We're just going to do that. No, you can't do that. You're not fucking Adolf Hitler. You don't just go into the Sudetenland and take it. That's not how it works in America. You can't. It's not a fascist dictator tyrant who just, I'm going to do this. And that's it. No, especially on issues with war, it has to go through Congress. It's clear right there in the Constitution. But when it's politically convenient for the Republicans, because they love war, but they hate Obama, and when it goes to shit, they want to be able to say, just blame him. Because of that, they're saying, hands off, give him the money, but don't approve the war. And, of course, the Democrats, in their infinite naivete and stupidity, they're like, ooh, I guess it's good that they're approving Obama without putting it in writing. You clowns! And when the situation in Syria gets less stable, what are the Republicans going to do? They're going to turn around and only blame Obama. And you, the Democrats, they're going to say, we never said we were for Syria. Where's the vote? Point to the vote. Is there a vote? There's not a vote, is there? You don't see a vote that says we were for Syria. It was the Democrats who were for Syria. We were right all along. We were against it. They're going to say that. Watch. You know, let's say, hypothetically, Assad gets toppled and there's this giant power vacuum. Who the fuck's going to fill that power vacuum? I'll tell you, ISIS is going to fill that power vacuum. It's going to be an even worse situation than it is right now. And what's going to happen? They're going to say, oh, well, you blame Obama, obviously. It's all Obama's fault. It's all the Democrats' fault. And it's all because the Democrats are refusing to be really hard on them and say, no, no, we're going to pull out everybody and everything until you make a decision. I mean, that's what you should do. And actually, if I was the Democrats, I would say I don't want people in there in the first place. So I would just pull them out anyway. But if they're not going to hold them accountable, because the Democrats don't know what the fuck they're doing. And unfortunately, when they're in power, they get a lot more warlike than they were when they weren't in power. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, Eric Bolling of Fox News has a really strong commitment to free speech, except for when he doesn't. So that should be a fun conversation. All right, stay right there, guys. We'll be right back.
Let's go. It's an old man, not be that bad. You trail, you're an animal, a wild-eyed version of yourself. There's an untamed beast deep within you, but which one? Are you agile and fearless on the climb? Or do you settle in for the long haul with steely resolve? Or do you fly, fast and light, across the landscape? At Basque, we make shoes and boots for the trail that move with you, no matter which beast you're trying to let out. Find out what's within you. Take our quiz at Basque.com.
News has a really strong commitment to free speech, except for when he doesn't. So check out what he said after the Muhammad cartoon incident in Texas.
Oh, it's Law Enforcement Week. We talked about that. Check out Westfield, New Jersey.
Too fast. Wow.
This is
wrong. Smooth. Here we go.
Quite a week for the Constitution when a provocateur flicked her finger on the ear of radical Muslims. Radical Muslim Hood sent two thugs to take her out. The good guys with the guns shot and killed the bad guys with the guns. The Second Amendment is alive and well. Thank the good Lord for that. The ensuing debate became how much speech is protected speech. By overwhelming majority, most people agree that no matter how hateful or downright stupid speech is in America, it's protected. The First Amendment, still breathing. So, whether it's a cartoon contest that offends radical Islamics, or a flag burning offends patriots, or a sculpture that offends Christians, it's speech, it's expression, and it's protected under the First Amendment. Progressives, like Larry Wilmore, push back on the free speech argument, suggesting drawing a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad goes too far. They say it becomes hate speech or fighting words. They're dead wrong. Free speech is protected no matter how inciting it may be. We're becoming too politically correct. We worry that offending Muslims somehow overrides our own constitutional rights. Remember, over a million American men and women have died defending those rights. We need to stop worrying how the rest of the world feels about us. We should make the rest of the world worry how we feel about them, and that includes radical Islam.
Hmm. I actually agree with all of that. I think that's 100% correct. He said, quote, "No matter how hateful or stupid speech is, it's protected." Hear, hear, Eric, I agree. He also said, quote, "Free speech is protected no matter how inciting it may be." Hmm. And we know that he's consistent on this, right? It's not like he's going to flip and be against free speech. When it's attacking a group that he likes,
Oh, it's Law Enforcement Week. We talked about that. Check out Westfield, New Jersey High School, one of the art exhibits they have there. Now, you can't really see it, but if we zoom in on one of a couple of the pictures, this is an art exhibit called Law Enforcement Police Brutality. Now, a friend of mine, a detective from Livingston Police Department, emailed me this. He said the law enforcement community across the country is outraged at this. You know, I get the idea of free speech, but hey, teachers at Westfield, would you do it? Would you put up an art exhibit showing teachers abusing students? I don't think you do it, nor should you have done that. I'd like to see that thing taken down.
Dude, he did that last rant just a few weeks ago. He's just a stupid person. He doesn't have a high IQ. His brain doesn't function well. His brain, in fact, I'm on the verge of saying his brain is broken. But at no point when you were prepping for that segment, I mean, they're on fucking national TV. They prepped for the segment. When you were prepping for the segment, you didn't think at all, and nobody in the room said, dude, yeah. You see, like, just a few weeks ago, you were talking about how free speech is always, no matter how inciting or stupid or hateful the speech is, it's cool, right? But now you're going to say that take it down because it offends me? You do realize that you're the textbook definition of a hypocrite, right? Nobody said anything. Greg Gutfeld, you know, Andrea Tantaros, or whatever the other one's name is, when they're in the meeting in the morning and they're thinking about what they're going to cover, nobody was like, okay, that hypocrisy, don't do that. They didn't. It escaped all of them. Why did it escape all of them? For something, I think, we talk about this all the time on the show, I genuinely believe that conservatives, many conservatives, definitely ultra-conservatives, they lack whatever thing it is that people have in their brains that allows them to detect when they're, you know, not applying the same standards to themselves that they apply to others. They lack the ability to notice their own hypocrisy. They can't, like, oftentimes with liberals, they can turn, you know, the criticism inward. And they go, instead of me lashing out, telling everybody, oh, what's wrong with you, what's wrong with you, what's wrong with you, how about, what's wrong with me, let me see what's going on here, let me see if I could work on myself and fix myself, and are my beliefs consistent? Liberals are more capable of doing that. Conservatives are just like, you know, blame everybody, scream about it, blah, blah, you just, I don't like that, I don't like that. But then when they're guilty of the same thing, then they flip positions completely. And notice, we always talk about how conservatives are more tribal by their nature. You see it happening right here. Because essentially what he's arguing is, but cops, you don't like cops? I know cops. I like cops. Cops are my friend. They're in my inner circle, so you can't speak out against them. I will censor you. But when somebody makes that argument about Muslims, I know Muslims. I like Muslims. They're my friends. They're in my inner circle. You can't make a cartoon of Muhammad. That's fucked up. That's when he's, of course I can, free speech. So you agree with free speech, except for when you don't. If it's attacking a group that you dislike, free speech away. But if it's attacking your people, oh, we must censor you. What a pathetic loser. So in conclusion, my response to Eric Bolling is as follows. Eric, understand this. No matter how hateful or stupid speech is, it's protected. Free speech is protected no matter how inciting it may be. Oh, right. Those were two quotes said by Eric Bolling. You just debunked yourself. All right. All right, now we go to Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly lashed out at Media Matters and Charles Blow, the New York Times columnist, and yet again he made a fool of himself covering poverty.
This man, Charles Blow, writes for the New York Times, put forth yet another unbelievably deceptive column about the incident, using out-of-context information provided by the smear website Media Matters, a far-left outfit that routinely defames Americans.
No.
Blow accuses me and Fox News of denigrating helpless individuals in a cruel and callous way. Quote, in 2014, during the week that marked the 50th anniversary of LBJ's war on poverty, O'Reilly again said that true poverty, as opposed to make-believe poverty, is being driven by personal behavior, which included, according to him, addictive behavior, laziness, apathy. O'Reilly has indeed repeatedly called poor people lazy, and the subject of his remarks is that many poor people are pathologically and undeservedly dependent on the government dole, unquote. Wow. Once again, Mr. Blow is a deceiver, a man who has partnered up with an internet hate operation instead of doing his own research. Lazy might pertain to Charles Blow. Here's what I actually said about the poor. True poverty is being driven by personal behavior, not an unfair economic system. In 1963, just 6% of American babies were born out of wedlock. Now, 41% are, and that includes 72% of African American babies. According to Heritage, single-parent homes are 4 times more likely to be living in poverty, and children raised by single parents are 3 times more likely to end up in prison, 50% more likely to be poor as adults. So maybe we should have a war against chaotic, irresponsible parents. Addictive behavior, laziness, apathy will all override social justice programs. Every child on this planet can learn, but parents must drive the process by forcing the kids to perform in school. Now, obviously, that's a lot different than me calling poor people names.
No, it's not.
Mr. Blow would know that if he was an honest person.
Oh, come on, but he is not.
What Blow really cares about is attacking anyone who does not buy into the grievance industry that he promotes and adores. I clearly blame irresponsible parents for much of the poverty in the USA, and the situation is getting worse. In 2005, the poverty rate in America was 12.6%. 2013, the last stats available, 14.5%. That despite almost $4.5 trillion in anti-poverty spending over that period of time. Clearly, federal and state programs trying to neutralize poverty aren't working.
No, clearly they are working. In that time frame you just put up, we had a Great Recession. We had a Great Recession, and poverty basically held steady. So you do realize if the anti-poverty programs weren't there, that during the Great Recession, the poverty rate would have shot up at least 10%. How do you not see these things? He's such a clown, man. And I love he's berating Charles Blow. Charles Blow said that I called poor people lazy. Let's go to the tape so you can see how I did exactly that. Bill, you didn't help your case by showing, you know, your talking points from back then. You're saying the exact same thing that Charles Blow accused you of saying. It doesn't help your case. You look like a fool. And notice, he did. He started out his rant by saying, you know, the problem is personal behavior. But, dude, how can the problem of poverty be personal behavior when, for example, we have tens of millions of working poor people in America? Working poor people. People can work a full-time job and not make enough money to pay for basic necessities. How is that a personal problem? They're working full-time and they're not making enough money to live a decent life. It's not a personal problem. That's a systemic problem. Anybody with a brain can see that. But you're doing propaganda. That's the problem. No matter how much evidence we present to you that your position is incorrect, you double down and you triple down and you berate the other people and you call them dishonest. Bill, there were just 100 stories that broke detailing your very lies. You're going to talk about honesty? You're going to talk about the honesty of somebody else. Do you want me to go through your lies again here? Would you like that? Would you appreciate that? We don't need to do that, but I'll just give you one. When he said he saw nuns get shot in the back of the head. Meanwhile, after an investigative report, they found out that Bill O'Reilly arrived to the scene where that happened a year later. He said he saw, I guess we're doing two examples. He said he saw in Ireland. He was there for the war. He wasn't there for the war. He was there after the war. And he said, in one of his books, I saw Irishmen blow up their fellow countrymen. And then he changed that to, no, what I mean is when I got there a year later, somebody showed me pictures of that happening. I looked at it on Google. Does that mean I was there? I guess I could say I was there, according to Bill O'Reilly. You want more lies? I can give you more lies if you want. How dare you bring up honesty? You're the most dishonest person I've ever seen in media, you clown. Now, furthermore, he is incorrect on the idea, clearly, anti-poverty programs haven't worked. Really? So let me get this straight. Your contention is if you take money and give some money to people who have no money, that you didn't just give them some money. So if you help people with a safety net, you're not actually helping people. Okay, Bill, just from at face value, that's ridiculous. But we don't even need face value because I'm going to prove it to you. Let's look at the first chart here. We showed this before recently. This is what the poverty rate would be without government programs. 29%, nearing 30%. Now, what is it without government programs? I'm sorry, what is it with government programs? 15%. Cuts it in half. Government safety net programs cut poverty in half. I got more for you. Look at this next chart. This is the poverty rate from 1959 to 2007. Remember, this is about when the war on poverty kicks in up until 2007. Look at that graph. Look at that line. Notice that sharp decline in poverty. You think it has anything to do with the fact that we finally put into place some safety net programs? No, it couldn't have anything to do with that. Let's look at the next chart here. Okay, this is... from the Census Bureau, this is the empirical data as to how many people are kept out of poverty because of various government programs. Social Security kept 26.6 million people out of poverty. Tell me again how the war on poverty doesn't help at all. Refundable tax credits, 9.4 million people out of poverty. Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that's food stamps, 5 million people out of poverty. Supplemental Security Income, 3.3 million people out of poverty. Housing subsidies, 2.8 million people out of poverty. Unemployment, 2.4 million people out of poverty. Child support, 1.3 million people. School lunch programs, 1.2 million people. Public assistance, which I think is the classic welfare program, 641,000 people out of poverty. The WIC program, 397,000 people out of poverty. Workers' compensation, 320,000 people. Low-income energy assistance, home energy assistance, 260,000 people out of poverty. Okay. To say that the war on poverty doesn't help is honestly one of the dumbest things I've ever heard. Again, it's akin to saying if you take money, if you take tax dollars and give it to poor people, you didn't just help them. You didn't just make them less poor when you literally just made them less poor. That's the argument you're making. That's how dumb you are. Look, the argument they make is, well, what happens is you set up, they become addicted to that money, and they don't want to try to work hard to get out of that situation. So you created a poverty trap. Except that's not true. Except we know that's not true. So if that were true, what would we see? We would see people abusing these programs, right? We would see people, you know, saying, fuck work, I'm not going to try to work anymore. Just give me the money from the government and shut the fuck up. I'm not going to try, I'm not going to do anything. I'm checking out of the system and just taking the money. So first of all, you can't do that because these programs have caps on them. They end at a certain point. But second of all, so what is the fraud rate? And take the SNAP program, the food stamp program. If people get lazy on these programs, they don't want to work anymore. So what's the fraud rate in this program? 1%. So, okay, Bill, you got a point. With 1% of people. With 1% of people, you're right. The safety net makes them lazier, and it makes them not want to work as hard. You're right. With 1% of the people. So do you want to put your middle finger up to 99% of the people? Who just need a helping hand in a hard time? Is that what you want to do? Apparently that's what you want to do. And I'll just give you a few more points here. Between 1960 and 1995, the official poverty rate of senior citizens, so people age 65 and older, fell from 35% to 10%. Tell me again how social programs don't work. 35% to 10%. 35% to 10%. But according to Bill O'Reilly, no. If you have a program set up, everybody stops wanting to work and they sit on the couch and we pay them, and then you actually hurt them when you do that. I've heard that conservative bullshit argument 1,000 times. There's no data for it. You make it up and you run with the argument anyway. And you want to know why you do that? Because you don't like poor people. It's that simple. You look at poor people and you say, you just don't have the same moral character I do. You know, you're addicted to substances, you fuck too much, you have too many kids. I don't like you. I don't like you. You're not good people. I don't care about you. That's what you think. So, Bill, what I want you to do is just come out and say that. Say, I don't like poor people. They're not worth as much as wealthy people to me. Just say it. Because that's what you believe. We know that's what you believe. All this veiled talk and trying to dress it up in a slightly more intellectual way and failing, by the way. Look, here's some more things Bill O'Reilly said when talking about social safety net recipients. Quote, are you weak? He said that in the past. Millionaire O'Reilly, this is a headline on Media Matters, Millionaire O'Reilly lectures struggling Americans, save $25,000 by cutting out vices and saving pocket change. Now, see, that's Bill O'Reilly's answer to poverty. Why aren't you saving $25,000 by cutting out pocket change? Shows you how disconnected he is. O'Reilly, quote, "All the things that poor people have proves America doesn't really have any destitution anymore." O'Reilly, quote, "Irresponsible and lazy. That's what poverty is." There you have it, man. You know, you can yell at Charles Blow all you want, you can yell at Media Matters all you want, but the problem, Bill, is you and your way of thinking and your ideology, which is simply put, incorrect. All right, now we go to Gavin McInnes. Gavin McInnes made a giant ass of himself on Sean Hannity's show while discussing women's rights, and in a way I actually like this guy. And the reason I say that is he represents the conservative id. That's what he is. And he says what a lot of really old guys are probably thinking, what a lot of really old, ultra-conservative people are probably thinking. Watch this.
I think this is sort of God's way, this is nature's way of saying, women should be at home with the kids. They're happier there.
I hope that your viewers do not take you, sir, seriously.
There's a great book you should read. It's called Why Men Earn More, and it's all about women choosing to put family over work, and that's why they earn less.
Having a choice does not mean that you're less ambitious, and your comments are absolutely deplorable. Sean, I would like
less
you...
Less ambitious in the world.
I would like you to adjust this. You're a father. You have a daughter.
Heroes. If you were a real feminist, you would support housewives and see them as the heroes,
you
and women who work wasting their time.
You said that women are less ambitious.
Women are
you
less
have
ambitious.
Said, you have also said that women are better suited in the home.
Yes,
you've
that's
also
a fact.
Said that, let's see, that women are emotional and women shouldn't run for public office. All of these things that just
I never said
absolutely...
women shouldn't run for
yes,
public
you
office.
Have. You've said
if we're
that
talking
before.
About 50% of the population, generally out of this 250 million people or 150 million people, most women are happier at home. They are pretending that they like working and they're not making money because they don't stay all night at the office. They don't go the extra mile.
Why
they don't
I
work all
here?
Weekend.
I'm
You're making a mistake.
Here.
You would be much happier at home with a husband and children.
Oh, boy.
I'm literally
You just said you're single.
Oh.
You don't have a boyfriend. You're what?
That's
you're celibate? Yeah, look, you're miserable. You would be so much happier with kids around you tonight. Imagine coming home. Mommy's home.
You know what, Gavin? You're not funny. You're not what you
I'm
not you do not
to be funny.
Do
I'm
anything.
Trying to make you happy.
You do not do anything for the better. Sean,
yes,
this isn't funny.
Feminism has made women miserable. Women were much happier when housewives were glorified.
I had a choice to be married, and I chose not to.
Right,
I have a choice
up.
Not to.
You made a mistake.
We'll give you the last word. Go ahead.
I think that your guest here is doing a disservice to all of the viewers and doing a disservice to America by saying that women, that I need to be married, that I would be happier at home. That you're, what, miserably married? Just because
no,
just
I'm
having
ecstatic.
A ring
I'm trying
on,
to share my joy. You should see my little
not
two-year-old.
Not everybody has the same life, the life pattern as you, okay?
I know, it's the fall.
And not everybody wants
it's
to marry somebody in a
bootleg
seersucker suit
and
go home to that. I don't.
Now, I know that a lot of feminists watch my show, but also a decent number of people who are kind of agnostic on women's issues, or at least taking a side, a hard side on the issues. And even some men's rights people watch my show. But my question for everybody is this. Can anybody really listen to that guy and not think he's a buffoon? Seriously, is there anybody who listens to him and goes, yeah, he's got it. He's spot on. Because I'm sorry, but if you agree with him and you believe the things that he believes, I think you're a silly person. And yes, I do think you're a sexist. I don't know what else one would call that right there. If that's not sexism, sexism doesn't exist. Let me give you some of the things he said. He said, women should be at home with the kids. They're happier there. Okay, I don't even know what that means. But women should be at home with the kids, they're happier there. so you can speak on behalf of all women, the gender, women. I know what you want. You want to be home with the kids. How the fuck do you know? But just through personal experience, we can disprove this one. Have you ever met a woman who's more, you know, into her job than you are? Have you ever met a woman who's excited to do what they do for a living, or they have a hobby outside of just serving men that makes them, that really makes them light up with enthusiasm? Have you met women more ambitious than you? I used to work at a car dealership briefly. Virtually every woman who worked there was more ambitious than me at that job. 100%. This idea of women should be home with their kids, they're happier there. You don't speak on behalf of all women, and you have no fucking clue what different women believe. Women are individuals. Just like men are individuals, and you ask, hey man, what's your favorite food? What's your favorite color? What's your favorite movie? And you get different answers? Same thing with women, big guy. They're not all the same. You know, just, oh, get in the kitchen because that's who you are. Really? Really? How about somebody like Annika Sorenstam, for example, or, you know, any other, Serena Williams, Venus Williams. I mean, we could go on and on here. What's the name of the number one female CEO of Yahoo? Forgive me, I don't know her name because I don't really follow that kind of business stuff that closely. Hillary Clinton. You know, really? You're going to tell all those women, get in the kitchen? Really? That's where they want to be? You just said that they're happier there. Who are you saying? Are there some women who want to be in the kitchen? Yeah. But you know who supports them being there? Pretty much everybody. There's only a very tiny fringe of people who say, I don't want you to do what you want to do if you're a woman and you want to be in the kitchen. He said, real feminists support housewives, and they think that female workers are wasting their time. No, see, that would be the opposite of a feminist. So a real feminist should say, all women should just be housewives. That's like defining the rigid role assigned to women as what a feminist should be. That's like taking the 1950s housewife and saying, you are a feminist. But no, it required a backlash to get away from that, to allow women an equal chance to do what they want to do. So look, are there a small fringe of feminists that say, you know, basically reject that way of living, the idea of being a housewife and taking care of your husband and the kids? There's a small group of, you know, I would call them neo-feminists or third-wave feminists who are extreme in that respect, where they say, yeah, like, women shouldn't be in the kitchen at all. But that the overwhelming majority of feminists and the overwhelming majority of people, here's what we think of when we think of how a woman spends her time. Do whatever you want to do. So if you want to be in the workplace, if you want to have a career, I fucking support you. If you want to be in the kitchen, or you want to do that old, you know, old school role that that women used to do, I support you there too. It's your choice. Whatever you want to do. But what he's doing is he's flipping it. He's saying, no, a real feminist is a woman who does what I say and gets in the kitchen and shuts her fucking mouth. And then he said, you would be much happier at home with a husband and children. Dude, shut the fuck up. You know nothing about her. You don't know her. You don't know her. She's telling you to your face, I do not believe the thing that you're telling me I believe. And you're going, yes, you do, because I say so. I ran into this trouble the other day on Twitter. I run into it all the time. People like to tell me what I believe on an issue because of a misinterpretation or a misperception that they got from something I said. No, you believe this because I'm telling you believe this. Okay, but I'm telling you right here. I'm talking to you. I'm me. I know what I believe. I know what I think. I'm telling you what I believe. No, you don't believe that. You don't believe that. Why would you not listen to what she says? She's telling you what she believes, and it's not what you say. Okay. But see, this is what I mean. He's dense. He's dense. There's fucking concrete in his head. That's the problem. He doesn't listen. Listen, tough guy. All right, I know I'm Mr. Macho Man. I'm going to yell at women, tell them their place. But you sound like a stupid person, because you are a stupid person. It's clear that you're not bright. And then finally, the best part, he goes, I'm trying to make you happy. Oh, I know. He had to finish it with the patronizing. It's okay, little girl. You know, I'll be nicer to you because you're a woman. I'll go softer on you because you're a woman. I'm just trying to make you happy by telling you everything about your life and what you should do. Piss off, man. If anybody's miserable and if anybody doesn't know what the fuck they're doing in life, it's clearly you.
because you look borderline psychotic, not just with the substance of what you're saying, but even with your mannerisms and your actions and your insistence in this rigid ideology. You're just fucking out to lunch, dude. That's the only way I can describe it. All right. Take a quick break. When we come back, Alan West versus the Pope, Sam Harris and Noam Chomsky, and some crazy stuff from Vice. All right, stay right there, guys. We'll be right back real quick. Quick break.
Yeah, here you're going home. And then someday we can take our time to brush the leaves aside so you can reach us. We might share in something great. Well, won't you look at where we're grown? Won't you look at where we're grown? And then someday comes tomorrow holds sense of what I fear for you in my mind. As you trip the fine line, and that cold day when you lost control. Shame you left my life, but then you should have told me.
Back, guys. We're back. Okay. Sorry, quick break, because like I said, I got a hell of a lot of stuff to get to, and not that much time. I'm going to go ahead and jump ahead here and do the Sam Harris Noam Chomsky thing, because I want to make sure I get it in. All right, I got a clip for this. There we go. So, recently, Sam Harris and Noam Chomsky had a back and forth via email, and at the time I first read it, I told everybody I wasn't going to do a segment on it, simply because it's pretty dense, and it's hard to cover every aspect well, especially on a show like mine, where I only have a given amount of time per segment. Well, now Sam Harris has done two follow-ups to the email exchange between him and Chomsky. One was in writing, and another one was a 10-minute podcast. And I'm going to play you a piece of that in a second. So clearly I changed my mind here, and I am going to cover it. I'm only covering it because I was more interested in Sam's response than in the original email exchange. But before I continue here and play the little segment for you, let me just urge you guys to read the entire exchange first. Read the entire exchange, then read Sam's first follow-up, and get all the information that you can and make up your own mind before you weigh whether or not you agree with my take on this. Because I have to admit, I've gotten people asking me about this for a while now, and I see a lot of varying opinion on this. I see people who are 100% Team Chomsky after reading it, some that are 100% Team Harris, some that are more in the middle. So, I don't want you to view my take as the end-all, be-all and the definitive on this. Go through everything yourself, come to your own conclusion, then, you can come back and listen to this. I'm responding to one of Sam Harris's follow-ups. So, with that being said, here's part of Sam's second follow-up. This is from his podcast.
I really was trying to have a productive conversation with Chomsky. And I encountered little more than contempt and false accusations and highly moralizing language, I mean, accusing me of apologizing for atrocities, and then weird evasions and silly tricks. It was a horror show. Now, I concede that I made a few missteps. I should have dealt with Chomsky's charges that I had misrepresented him immediately and very directly. They are, in fact, tissue thin. I did not misrepresent his views at all. I simply said that he had not thought about certain questions when I should have said he had thought about them badly. Those of you who have written to tell me that what I did to Chomsky is analogous to what has been done to me by people who actually lie about my views, you're just not interacting honestly with what happened here. I did not misrepresent Chomsky's position on anything. And insults aside, he was doing everything in his power to derail the conversation. And the amazing thing is that highly moralizing accusations work for people who think they're watching a debate. They convince most of the audience that where there's smoke, there must be fire. I mean, for instance, when Ben Affleck called me and Bill Maher racist, that was all he had to do to convince 50% of the audience. But I'm sorry to say, it was the same with Chomsky. I can't tell you how many people I heard from who think that he showed how ludicrous and unethical my concern about intentions was, for instance. That he's dealing in the real world, but all my talk about intentions was just a bizarre and useless bit of philosophizing. But think about that for a second. Okay, our legal system depends upon weighing intentions in precisely the way I describe. How else do we differentiate between premeditated murder and crimes of passion and manslaughter and criminal negligence and just terrible accidents for which no one is to blame? Imagine your neighbor's house burns down and yours with it. Okay, what the hell happened? Okay, well, what happened has a lot to do with your neighbor's intentions. Okay, if he had a cooking fire that got out of control, that's one thing. If he tried to burn down his own house to collect the insurance payment, that's another. If he tried to burn down the whole neighborhood because he just hates everyone, that's another. Intentions matter because they contain all the information about what your neighbor is likely to do next. There's a spectrum of culpability here, and intention is its very substance. Chomsky seems to think that he has made a great moral discovery in this area, and that not intending a harm can sometimes be morally worse than intending one.
Now, here's the problem, though, Sam. He didn't say that intentions don't matter. You are insisting that's what he believes, but if you read the email exchange, he makes clear, no, he does think intentions matter, and he thinks that oftentimes our intentions are just as bad as our enemies, if not sometimes worse. Now, you may totally disagree on that point, but you can't say that he doesn't think intentions matter. He does think they matter, and he's come to the conclusion that ours are either equally as bad to some of our enemies, or they're worse. But what I don't like about this is that I do think that Sam is now doing things to Chomsky or saying things about Chomsky that are akin to things that have been said against Sam that I've defended Sam for. Like, for example, I did a really angry segment responding to C.J. Worldman. I think it was on the live show. I'm not sure it made it to YouTube. But he basically said that, you know, Sam Harris and new atheism in general represents a white supremacist school of thought. It was honestly one of the dumbest fucking articles I've ever read, and he's doing nothing but straw-manning Sam the entire time and telling him he believes things that he doesn't believe, and it's clear CJ just wasn't listening to what Sam was saying, and he was just making shit up to fit what he thinks Sam believes, even though that's not what Sam believes. So I've defended Sam when people have done this against him, but now he is doing that to Chomsky, because, no, he does think intentions matter. He just doesn't agree with you when you essentially make the argument that, well, we can get a little bit more of a pass for when we fuck up because our intentions really are better. And the part that really fucking got over under my skin and pushed me over the top to comment on this is he said about Chomsky, he used weird evasions and silly tricks. Now, look, I read the entire exchange. It is certainly true that Chomsky was pissed, and it's certainly true that he was aggressive. There's no question about that. But I don't think he used any weird evasions or silly tricks. Look, I was in an email back and forth with Noam Chomsky when I was in, like, 10th grade. And I was curious. Somehow I got his email, and I asked him a question about nature versus nurture because I was in, like, a sociology class or a psychology class. And, you know, the teacher said something I didn't agree with, so I wanted to ask him what he thought about it. And, dude, he went back and forth with me, like, 10 times. There's a reason. No, if he was going to be like a dick to you, Sam, he would have not engaged you in any way, shape, or form. He would have not responded to you originally or brushed you off in the first email. No, you guys went back and forth a lot, and he took a lot of time in responding to you because he did take you seriously. He took you seriously, but he vehemently disagreed with what you were saying. And it's gotten to the point now where it is true that whenever somebody disagrees with Sam, he has this thing where it's like, oh, they just must not understand what I'm saying. No, he gets what you're saying, and he disagrees with it. Just acknowledge that, man. And the part about Ben Affleck was the one that sent me over the edge. Because he said, he's comparing having a conversation with Noam Chomsky where they get into details about the bombing of Al-Shifa to Ben Affleck on HBO. There's no fucking comparison, dude. Stop. And you know there's no comparison. You're going to compare one of the greatest intellectuals of all time, whether you agree or disagree with him, one of the most quoted intellectuals of all time, to Ben fucking Affleck? That's condescending and dismissive, and it's guilty of all the things that you accuse a lot of people who are against you of doing. And again, oftentimes they do. C.J. Worldman is the perfect example of that, right? He's totally dismissive of Sam, and he makes shit up oftentimes, and he is mischaracterizing him. But unfortunately, Sam is doing a lot of the same things to Chomsky here. Now, understand, I went into this email back and forth sympathetic to Sam because I do think that some progressives have smugly and unjustly dismissed him. You know, Reza Aslan, 50% of the time, I think he says some reasonable stuff, but looking at some of the stuff he said about Sam, it is unfair. Glenn Greenwald, I think he's brilliant on the NSA issues. I think he's brilliant on foreign policy, but he has been unfair to Sam. I totally think that's the case. Cenk, like I said with Dave Rubin in the conversation, I think Cenk has maybe flippantly simplified certain things with Sam. I don't think that he's trying to mischaracterize him or misstate him, but you can say that at times he's been way overly dismissive of Sam. So that has happened. There is no doubt that there's been a smug dismissal of Sam in progressive circles, so I was sympathetic to him going into this email back and forth. But in all seriousness, I think that I went out of the conversation more sympathetic to Chomsky's position. Not because I fell for any weird diversions or tricks, as Sam Harris would have you believe, because I read the arguments and I said, oh, it appears to me like Chomsky's making more sense. And this is what it all boils down to, if I can really, you know, zoom out here for a second and get as broad as I can in this greater conversation about, you know, U.S. foreign policy versus fundamentalist Islam, and to discuss that here for a second. Chomsky's point is this. We all think that we're the good guy. Every regime ever. And he gives the most extreme examples in the email back and forth, whether it's Japan or whether it's Nazi Germany. Every regime ever, ISIS today wakes up in the morning and they think they're doing the right thing. Every regime ever says we're doing the right thing. So Chomsky's point is, given that that's the case, how do you measure who really is doing bad actions around the world? And his only answer is just empirically measure it quantitatively. And look at, count up the bodies, see what's happening in that respect, who's torturing more, who's inflicting the most pain. And Chomsky's point is this. The U.S. is not, you know, a benevolent giant that means well, but whoops, sometimes we kill innocent people. No, we are focused primarily on our power, our control, and getting natural resources. And history bears this out. Post-World War II, that's definitely the case. So in many ways, we're a classic imperialist power. Now, ISIS does violence for Islamic doctrine. What Noam Chomsky is saying is, Sam, you can't say that in this moral spectrum of ISIS violence versus U.S. violence, that they're on two polar opposites, and one side is the good guy and one side is the bad guy. What he's saying is, it's much more like this. It's much more close to each other, where, yes, none of us would rather live under an ISIS system, for sure. But that then doesn't mean that you talk about U.S. foreign policy in this way where you continue to stress the point that, well, we mean well. Did we mean well when we did this after World War II? Here's just some of the places we have been involved in militarily post-World War II. China, Guatemala, Indonesia, Cuba, the Congo, the Dominican Republic, Peru, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, Lebanon, Grenada, Libya, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Iran, Panama, Iraq, Kuwait, Somalia, Bosnia, Sudan, Afghanistan, Yugoslavia. If I repeated myself, because we were in there more than once. just to be clear here. But this is only a partial list of that. Here are some of the authoritarian regimes we supported. Batista, Diaz, Duvalier, Pinochet, Marcos, Diem, Kagame, Mobutu. The list goes on and on here. So the point is, we don't get to, you know, talk about how, well, we do get a little bit more of a pass and we mean better, so let's focus on that point. No, since we pay our government, we fund it with our taxes. The reason why Chomsky's pretty much solely focused on the evils of the of U.S. foreign policy is because he feels responsible for it. So, you know, as Sam has said, he thinks a lot of these liberals, Reza Aslan, Glenn Greenwald, and, you know, Noam Chomsky, well, they're like apologists for radical Islam. No, what they're doing is they're focusing on what we have done wrong. That's their focus because they feel responsible for it. They weren't raised in ISIS-controlled territory. They don't pay ISIS. And ISIS is not doing shit in their name. Of course they disagree with what ISIS is doing, but they're focusing on what we do because they feel responsible for it. So the point is this. Are liberal values, broadly speaking, superior to theocratic values? Of course they are. There's no question about it. But a guy like Chomsky, the point that he's stressing is we can't use illiberal values in defense of liberal values. So even if we did supposedly mean well, if hypothetically we meant well in everything we were doing overseas, once we go and start toppling governments and torturing people and killing people and supporting stuff like that, all of a sudden it doesn't matter what the end goal was, what you cared about and the system you were trying to create, because you became the devil you were trying to avoid in the process. So it's like communism. Communism is brilliant in theory. It's great on a sheet of paper. It doesn't work empirically, but if you start killing people in the name of communism or killing people in the name of science or rationality, broadly speaking, well, now you just, you know, delegitimize everything you were doing because you started believing the ends justify the means. And that's people's concern with Sam when he keeps repeating himself and stressing the point, like, no, 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 you don't get it. But what I'm saying is, ISIS is worse because of reasons X, Y, and Z. And Chomsky's saying, dude, just break free from that hypothetical world for a second and look at this empirically. Empirically, because of U.S. foreign policy, it has done more wrong in the world because we have bigger guns and we have a more powerful military and we're the imperialist leader right now. So focus on that. I get it, man. Sam, I understand. In your perfect weapons, thought exercise, you're right, man. You're right. If you give al-Qaeda perfect weapons and you give George W. Bush perfect weapons, yes, al-Qaeda is going to kill everybody in the world. That's not exactly like them. That's obvious. We concede that point. We agree to that. George Bush isn't going to kill every innocent Muslim if he had perfect weapons, essentially. We get that point. But Chomsky's point is, that's not really relevant to the world we live in. They don't fucking have perfect weapons. Okay? That's about as relevant as the point I make about the death penalty. I agree with it in theory. I agree with it philosophically. If we have perfect information and this guy slaughtered 80 kids or whatever, yeah, I want that guy to die. No problem with it whatsoever. But the problem is, empirically in the real world, sometimes we kill the wrong people, right? So I'm against a systemic death penalty. By the same token, you know, we could talk about how ISIS with perfect weapons would absolutely be the worst ever, for sure, yeah. But we're only in the realm of the philosophical. Bring it down to the empirical. Bring it down to a data-driven level, and you realize, in this world, more people have died because of U.S. foreign policy, and we're responsible for that. So when you talk about violence and atrocities and you're only focusing on the evils of a smaller group in some other place of the world that you're not responsible for, it comes across as condescending and pedantic and weird. And it appears as if you're missing the point, and you do buy into this idea that, well, since we mean much better, you know, we get more of a pass, and a guy like Chomsky is morally confused when he doesn't acknowledge that. All right. I'm running out of time. I got to squeeze in as much as I can. Alan West is going to slam the Pope for arguably one of the best things the Pope has ever done.
All right. So finally, what's your comments on the recognition of a Palestinian state by the Vatican?
This is horrific. you know, at a time when Islamic terrorists are slaughtering Christians, Catholics, all over the Middle East, for the pontiff to recognize a terrorist organization, which is really either Hamas or Fatah, they're both terrorist organizations. It's just the degree of the actions that they're taking. This is unconscionable that he is doing that. And it just goes to show the level of propaganda success that the Palestinians have and the level of disdain and anti-Semitism there is out there. And it is even coming from the Vatican now.
Yeah, it is very sad. I couldn't agree more.
Oh, yeah, great interview. I couldn't agree more. You're 100% right, Alan. Say more. Okay, the Pope is an anti-Semite because he wants there to be a Palestinian state. So the Pope is an anti-Semite because he wants long-term peace in the region. How do you respond to such stupidity? So anybody who wants a Palestinian state hates Jews? Anybody who wants that is an anti-Semite? Well, okay, let's flip the argument then. Anybody who doesn't want a Palestinian state, anybody who only wants an Israeli state, is an Islamophobe. You hate Muslims. How about that? See, if we flip it back on you, it's, oh, we don't hate what he's talking about. But when you throw it on the Pope and you put it on people who want a Palestinian state, somehow that makes sense. He's an anti-Semite. No, anti-Semitic means that you have an irrational hatred of Jews. Okay, you have an irrational hatred of that group. It's not an irrational hatred when you want a two-state solution and you want peace in the region. Nobody's saying, hey, how about we obliterate Israel and give the entire thing to the Palestinians? Just kick all the Jews off. That's it. Nobody's saying that. If they were saying that, you'd have a better argument. But nobody's saying that. They want peace. They want equal representation in world governments. They want a long-term solution. But apparently now, if you want a long-term solution, you hate Jews. Vice released a sneak peek into their upcoming story on homosexuality in Uganda, and it's absolutely chilling.
Unfortunately, this sentiment only seems to intensify with adults. Like these men we spoke to in this working class neighborhood in Kampala.
Tell me something about Ugandan culture.
The first thing we hate is homosexuality. If we find the woman, we pull out one and we do it.
You do what?
He's saying they rape women who are lesbians.
You cannot allow a woman to be in sex with a fellow woman.
Have you ever raped a lesbian?
Yeah. Serious raping.
Serious raping.
Because when you feel woman to woman, then to me, you need to be in the sex. And we get you a man who is seriously needing a woman, and they rape you seriously.
So what would you do if you saw a gay man?
Kill! 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 You kill that one.
Just
man
kill.
And the woman, kill!
I just kill this.
Woman and woman will rape. But how... Man and man.
Handy man. I feel completely repulsed, sick to my stomach. It seems like this is so deeply ingrained. Just pure hatred towards homosexuals.
That's incredible. In Gambia as well, the dictator Yahya Jammeh said, I will slit your throat. Quote, I will slit your throat. Talking to gay people. A leader of a country said that. I will slit your throat if you're gay. What's always so stunning to me is that you can tell that they think they're more moral. They think they're more moral than gay people. But, hey, asshole, first of all, putting aside the question of morality of homosexuality, I obviously think there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. But even if you do believe homosexuality is immoral, what's more immoral on the spectrum than homosexuality? Oh, I don't know, maybe rape and murder, which is what you just said you do to respond to homosexuality? Look in the mirror. You guys are the immoral ones. You're imposing on somebody else's life because you disagree with what they're doing when they're not hurting anybody else. To be against, it just doesn't make any sense to be against homosexuality. It just means you're a myopic douche if you're against homosexuality. And look, the arguments boil down to what? It's my religion. My religion teaches me that's wrong. Who cares? So you have a religion. You practice the tenets of your religion and leave everybody else the fuck alone. They ain't got nothing to do with you. If you want to live by some weird rules that came out of a book from some people in the desert thousands of years ago, by all means, waste your fucking life. I don't give a shit. Do whatever you want. But that's got nothing to do with them. Your religion doesn't give you the right to put it onto them. So that argument is donezo. Then the culture is another one. Well, we're just used to doing it. We kill gay people. That's what we do. We rape women who are gay. We kill men who are gay. We're used to it. The fact that it's your culture doesn't make it right. If at any point we could have used that argument throughout history, then, oh, slavery, when slavery was happening. What do you mean? It's just, it's our culture. It's what we're used to doing. We can't change it. It's our culture. Yes, you can change it, and yes, you should, because it's fucking dumb, and it's immoral. And the final thing would be their opinion. That's the only other argument they could use to hate gay people. It's just, I just don't like them. It's my opinion. Well, again, I don't know why you think that allows you, gives you the green light to kill somebody or to do an injustice against them. Even if it is your opinion, okay, keep it to your fucking self or verbalize it. You can be as hateful as you want with your speech, but when you physically assault people or kill people or rape people, you become the problem. So these are all basic moral things that these guys don't get, and it's unfortunate and it's sad because the year is 2015, and in many places in the world, they still have a moral compass, on, especially on social issues, that's back so many years. All right, and finally, Bill Cosby. We don't really have time for it, but I'll squeeze it in anyway. Pause. I said squeeze it in while talking about Bill O'Reilly. Fail. Bill Cosby. Yeah, Bill Cosby, not Bill O'Reilly. Fail again. Bill Cosby gave his first interview since roughly 16,000 women accused him of rape, and he responded with absolute gibberish.
Now to that ABC News exclusive, Bill Cosby responding to questions about allegations of sexual assault for the very first time. The actor and comedian is in Alabama, where he is spreading his message about education, preparing to speak with students later today. ABC's Lindsay Davis caught up with him there. This morning, embattled comedian Bill Cosby trying to change the narrative. For the first time, responding to questions about the barrage of sexual assault allegations.
Are you prepared for the backlash? If a young person comes up to you and says, you know, my mom says you've done some bad things, how will you answer them? If they are pressing you, are you guilty? Did you do it? Are the allegations true?
I'm not sure that they will come like that. I think that many of them say, well, you're a hypocrite. You say one thing, you say the other.
Well, you're a rapist. You are.
The point is, okay, listen to me carefully. I'm telling you where the road is out. Now, you want to go here or you want to be concerned about who's giving you the message?
Since November, allegations have resurfaced with more than 30 women coming forward, some accusing Cosby of drugging or sexually assaulting them. His side has issued a number of denials, and Cosby has never been criminally charged. But in an effort to turn the page, Cosby, now part of an initiative, invited by the Black Belt Community Foundation to help bring awareness about the state of underfunded schools near Selma, Alabama, but online a firestorm.
Are you concerned at all that, given the allegations, that that may overshadow your message?
I have been in this business 52 years, and I've never seen anything like this. And reality is the situation.
Oh, come on. I know I shouldn't be laughing. I know it's hard for me to laugh, but it's complete. Everything he's saying is gibberish. There's no point there. He's like, the kid listens to the rap music and they give it with the zip zop, zoom a da bop, hello puddin' ops. Makes some sense, Bill. Makes some sense. He can't. Look, man, we got to say it at this point, right? 30 plus women now have accused him of rape. They don't have anything to gain from it. There's no upside to this. It's not like they're doing it and they're getting money or this is happening or that is happening. No, dude. Guilty. Guilty, 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 guilty. How many stories have to come out? Accusations don't mean he's guilty, but the way they came about and the details of how they came about, I think it's pretty clear. And the fact that he's on TV now going, with the Jell-O pudding pops and the kids with the rap music and the bomb, I didn't do it, but I'm not saying I didn't do it. Yahoo! You like my Bill Cosby impression? All right, guys. I love you. I'll see you on Monday, everybody. Peace. Have a good one.